The main thing I want to tell you about is what do we use instead of puzzles to try and decide when there will be these magic subspaces that let one prove inequalities. So I'm going to try and give you the barest minimum on cohomology rings, because that's really where this calculation is going to be. It's going to be in a cohomology ring. So what is a cohomology ring? We start with X, and X is going to be some topological space. And there's one. There's a topological space. And we associate to it in some way that will not be at all described. We associate to it this thing called H upper star X. And if you put the star below, then you're describing something else, the homology groups. So be careful where you put the star, because people care. But I don't think I'm going to talk much about H0, H1, H2, which is this is put together from. I'll just have the upper star there to remind me that it's cohomology. And what this is, it's a ring, which you should think of as a vector space with a multiplication. And even better, it's a commutative ring very often for the spaces we're going to be thinking about. It's not quite commutative. More generally, it's super commutative. It's got an even piece and an odd piece, and the odd things anti-commute, and they commute with the even piece. But for the x's we care about, the odd piece will be 0. So it's pretty much a commutative ring for purposes of this lecture.
Excuse me. You say vector space with multiplication. Why is this a ring rather than an algebra?
An algebra is a ring. An algebra is better than a ring, that it's not only an abelian group but a vector space. So,
I didn't think a ring had scalar multiplication.
Well, it does if I take my ring, if I take my cohomology ring to have coefficients in a field. So let's do so. Yeah.
Cohomology usually has different orders or
dimensions. H0, H1, H2. Yeah. Put them all together. Particularly, put the even ones together first and the odd ones together second, and notice that the odd ones actually are going to be all 0 for us. So,
and you can multiply elements in different orders?
Yeah, and the order will add. Yeah, but I'm not going to have to worry about that so much. So I'm going to write down examples of what these rings look like very soon. Let me say, but what's this really for? The idea is this is part of algebraic topology. And it was really invented to solve a Hilbert problem. And the Hilbert problem was to make Schubert calculus rigorous. So what Schubert did with these mystic playing on paper with symbols, meaning algebra, in order to do topology, it wasn't rigorous when he did it, and it took another 40 years or so, 30 years, for algebraic topology really to be sufficiently developed that that it could be. But what's it for? What's it for is to say we want to understand topological spaces, and particularly continuous maps between topological spaces, but when we actually want to compute anything, we want to do that with algebraic gadgets. You want to be able to add and multiply things and work with familiar things like polynomials or matrices, maybe not matrices because they're not commutative, but things like that to do our computations. And you might, particularly if we were doing this, if we were doing this with integer coefficients instead of real coefficients, then you might imagine that you're somehow going from this topological continuous point of view to dealing with something discrete. So let me say a little bit more about that. So I don't just want a rule that assigns a ring to every topological space. I also want, if I have a map, continuous map, between topological spaces, then I want a map on the cohomology rings called F upper star, and it goes the wrong direction. And that's really important, and that's why there's the co in cohomology. So there's also a theory of homology that's not as nice, really. It associates maps forwards. So why is it nicer to have maps go backwards? The example is you can take X and stick it inside X times X by just any particular point goes to the point twice, and that'll get you a map from this guy back to that guy, if cohomology does what it's supposed to do. And this is closely related to this guy tensor this guy. And what am I doing? I've got two elements of my cohomology, and I can multiply them together and get an element of my cohomology. So this is the reason that why there's the ring structure, the multiplication structure on cohomology. It's because we have this diagonal inclusion for any space, and I'm going to not tell you about that, but it's because it goes backwards. And if we thought about homology where it went forwards, then we'd have some sort of co-multiplication that's not as a familiar thing to play with. And people like multiplication better than co-multiplication. I can't talk about tensor. These are topological spaces.
Whatever that X is.
Well,
you have X something X.
Yeah, X times X. Uh-huh.
X times X. If you had X times Y, I wouldn't have a map.
Well, I started from a map, and then I got, right? So the point is, whenever I have any continuous map, I get a map on cohomology rings backwards. So this guy I always have, uh-huh. And that's why I get this map backwards in cohomology rings. This was really to get you to believe that having a map backwards is nicer than having a map forwards, even though the first time you see it, it seems a little strange. But it's so that we get a ring structure on things. Okay, so what's it for? What's it for is if I have Y inside X, so if I have some guy Y inside X, and Y is nice enough, and I'm certainly not going to explain what that would mean, we can associate a guy Y that's an element in the cohomology ring of X. And you should think of this as constraints. So I'm saying, well, I'm thinking about the set of all points in X, but then I want to impose this condition on them. And this is a way of recording that this condition has been imposed. Okay. And if I've got Y1 and it deforms to Y2, they get the same element of cohomology. So this is only recording rough things about these subspaces, and which is good because that gives it a chance to be something small and comprehensible, right? If you thought about all the subsets of X, then that's a huge thing to think about. But I want to impose lots of equalities to say I'm thinking about a very, very rough version of it in order to get something comprehensible. And so let me draw that on the picture. If I have this curve, or I have So that one's red, and this one's a slightly different color, pink. Those two curves, those guys will define the same element of cohomology. But if I have this one, it doesn't. There, you can't continuously deform this red curve and get that blue curve, or vice versa. But you could continuously deform the red and get the pink. Right? So, the Schubert varieties that we talked about, and I'll say what I mean. So these were in the Grassmannian, and they were relative to some Hermitian matrix, and I, remember here, was a subset of 1 up to n of size k. The Schubert varieties are nice enough. And their classes, which I'm going to call S sub I, of S Grassmannian, HI, are a basis of that cohomology ring. So now you at least know the dimension of one cohomology ring. That if I take the Grassmannian of K-planes and I take its cohomology, I've told you, if you, you know, take me as an oracle for this theory, then you at least now know that the dimension of this vector space is n choose k.
Well, in your definition of S sub I, h has disappeared. Are you taking?
If I go from one h to another h, right, then I can continuously deform from one h to another h. And that will continuously change this to the other guy, and then that will get that it doesn't matter what h was. They all sit in the Grassmannian. There's just the Grassmannian where you don't impose any conditions on your subspace. Right? I mean, this is the set of all k-planes. And then once I put on this, then I'm thinking about the k-planes that intersect this guy's eigenspaces a lot, I much. So they all sit inside. So what I'm computing here is the cohomology of the Grassmannian. If y1 and y2 are both inside x, and their intersection is nice enough, and one thing that is supposed to imply is that the codimension of y1 plus the codimension of y2 is equal to the codimension of the intersection. So what does that mean? Codimension is how many degrees of freedom you have lost by saying I'm in y1. So I say I'm in y1 and I'm in y2. And that should kill a certain number of degrees of freedom and a bunch more to get me down into the intersection. So this would be horribly false if, for example, y1 were equal to y2. Then I'd say, well, I'd like to be in y1. That's restrictive. I lose some degrees of freedom. And I'd like to be in y2. That actually, if y were equal to y2, you wouldn't be putting on any more conditions. So you wouldn't get this additivity. So this is a transversality statement that says they intersect really as little as you could expect them to. So, so if you have that, then the class of this intersection is the product of the two classes. So now you have a way of understanding what the multiplication is about. It's about saying I want to be in y1 and I want to be in y2. All right, so let's think about that in this case. So how about I call this guy y1, so the red one is y1, the pink one is y2, and the blue one is y3. All right? So in this case, what you find out is that if you take the class of y1 and you multiply by the class of y3, you get the class of a point. Which you might say, oh, it's this point. But I'm just going to say the class of a point, because this space is connected and I can deform any point to any other point. So all points, any single point, gets me the same cohomology class. Okay, what's the class of y1 squared? Well, you can't apply this rule straight away, but I claim you can still calculate it if you. Okay. So the class of y1 is this. So that's this. And now what's that? It's zero because these two things, or it's the class of the empty set, which is zero. Okay. Y2 isn't y1. The class of y2 is the class of y1. Y2 is not y1. This one's here, that one's there. Y2 is not y1. But the classes are equal. So that's why I put the brackets on to tell you which one is which. You know, it's confusing to say, you know, these are different, but these are equal. And that's why you have to be sure, are the brackets there or not. That's right. Yeah, you can't talk about intersection of classes. You can only talk about intersection of sets. Okay. So here's an interesting example. Let's think about the Grassmannian of two planes in four space. Or maybe I'll think about, let's say complex four space. Okay, so what was that? That was linear two planes in C4. You can correspond that with projective lines in projective space. Right? The definition of a projective one-dimensional space is that it's the projectivization of a linear two-dimensional space. So when I'm putting the word projective here, just subtracted one from each of these things. I got down to one-dimensional things and inside three-dimensional things. So I've got lines in space. Okay? Now what was F0101? So that's V in GR2C4, such that if you think about how V intersects these, then you find out there's a jump here, and there's a jump here, right? The jump is by 0, 1, 0, 1. That's what I have there, okay? So that was the definition of, that is not S0101. That's the Schubert variety. I'll say S0101 is the class of that. That's better. So how do you interpret this in this point of view? So this says I've got a two-plane and a one-plane, and they don't intersect. They intersect something zero-dimensional. The projective version of this is that the line doesn't contain this point. So our line doesn't contain this point. That's the projective version of the statement that this intersection is zero. Here I've got two different two planes in linear two planes, and I say that the intersection is one dimensional. Projectivize that statement, it says that our line intersects the standard line is a point, is one dimensional. So I'm talking about lines that touch another line. And then the next one says that it's not contained in the standard plane, but it is contained in the standard space, the whole space. Okay. So what S0101 is doing, I tried to say a cohomology class is expressing that you're satisfying some constraints. And this is lines, so this is the class of all lines touching some line. So I want to give you two calculations with that. One is, if I take this guy and I raise it to the fourth power, I claim I get 2 times the class of a point, which happens to be 2 times the class 1100. So that was the statement I made yesterday that I didn't prove, which is that if you specify 4 lines in space and think about how many lines touch all of them, the answer is 2, generically. So when you see this being raised to the fourth power, remember this trick. It's not really that I'm saying I'm counting lines that intersect this line and, oh, they intersect this line and this line and this line. I'm talking about ones that intersect 4 different lines in order to be able to apply this, and 4 generically placed lines. Okay, but let me give you one more such statement. What if I just take this? So now I'm thinking about lines touching L1 and L2 that are 2 lines in my projective space. Okay, what if a line touches L1 and L2? Let me think about some extreme case. It's supposed to be, I'm supposed to get the same thing as I move around, right? As I continuously deform, then this space of lines, this 2-parameter space of lines, is going to be the same. It doesn't really matter what L1 and L2 are, as long as they're generic enough. But let me think about this extreme case where L1 and L2 themselves meet. All right? What does a line look like if it touches both of these? And the answer is there's 2 possibilities. This is lines in the L1, L2 plane. That's one possibility. If a line going in the plane will touch both of these. And the other possibility is lines through the L1 intersects L2 point. If you go through that common point, then you intersect both of them. And under good cases, you get an additivity there. So that same thing here, that same thing there. And this one can work out is this Schubert class, and this one can work out as this Schubert class. So there's a jump at the beginning, says that we contain a certain point, and that's the point. By the time we get here, we've jumped all the way up to 2-dimensional. That means we're contained inside that plane, contained inside a plane. So this is a true statement, and this is the sort of thing that Schubert did when doing Schubert calculus. He wrote down equations like this and then used that to do calculations like this. So what the puzzles are doing is if you have one word and another word, and you want to know how to multiply these two, so I've got 2 elements of my cohomology ring. I multiply them together. That's probably not in my basis anymore. But I can expand it in my basis. If I have a basis, I should be able to expand it in my basis. So what are the coefficients? The number of puzzles with I here and J there and K there. And we did the calculation yesterday of counting the puzzles that had 0101 here and 0101 there, and then there were 2 possible values at the bottom, this and that. Okay, so what should you take away from this? that there's a way of thinking about how you impose generic constraints. There's this nice algebraic way of saying, I'd like to work inside some space X, and I'd like to impose various constraints on my points, this one and this one and this one. And as long as those constraints are independent enough, generic enough, then there's this algebraic tool that computes what the set of common solutions to all those constraints are. And that's this calculation in this cohomology ring. Okay, so that's what we're going to need to do to count how many of these magic W there are, and particularly find out whether the number is positive. And if it is, we get inequalities. Or not W now, but W and V, you know, or for the quantum marginal problem, and more complicated such things for more general pairs of groups. Are there any questions right now? So just one thing I want to say is, you could start with this, right? You could tell some high school students this. Here's some symbols, and here's how they multiply. And then comes the theorem. This multiplication rule that's defined on the S sub i's, it's commutative and associative. And now, how do you look at the puzzles and prove that it's commutative and associative? It's extremely not obvious to prove it's commutative. Really, I think the best way is to prove that it's the cohomology ring of the Grassmannian, and that's commutative. Proving it's associative is not quite as horrible. There's a nice proof using three-dimensional puzzle pieces. I will talk about. Anyway, so we don't have the puzzles. We do have the cohomology rings, but we don't have the puzzles for the general case. Yeah?
One other question. You wrote down there a product which is equal to zero. Well, normally we don't think of zero as an element of a ring.
Absolutely, zero is an element of a ring. Zero is in every ring. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Group. And in a group I only have times, I don't have plus. You know, here I've got plus and times. Right. So the plus was about unions. If your set can be nicely broken as a union of one piece and another piece, which I won't say what nicely means, but this is an example. If your set can be nicely broken as a union, then you get a plus. That you the class of the union is the sum of the classes. Okay. Any questions? I absolutely am doing simplicial homology here. If you want to do it that way, then you're going to need to say, you need to show you can triangulate the Schubert varieties so that they will have, so that the boundary will be zero and they will define classes in homology and cohomology. And there's general theorems, if you have a complex subvariety, it's triangulable, so yes. When you get into gross, horrible, fractal sorts of things, then people can disagree on what cohomology or homology means of your topological space. But for nice, smooth things like the Grassmannian, everybody agrees. There's just one definition of what homology and cohomology should mean, and I'm using that one definition. I mean, there's different isomorphic ways to think about it, but you get the same ring with this basis, no matter how you do it. Any questions? All right, so the point of Berenstein, Shamar, and Resser is, so okay, we have this H was pretty much a subgroup of G, at least it was mapping to G, and we had a coadjoint orbit for G. And inside there, I said the smallest H orbits on that coadjoint orbit for G could themselves be identified with coadjuvant orbits. So I've got this guy living inside here, which means I get a map backwards on cohomology. Okay, and inside here, I have the Shubert classes. And likewise inside here. So these, maybe I'll call them G Shubert classes and H Shubert classes. And now you can ask the question, if you start with one here, SI, and you, maybe I'll put a G on it to say it's one of the elements of this cohomology ring. So I've got an element of my basis here. And I take that element of my basis and I map it into here, then it's going to be some combination of the basis here. So some coefficients, ij. Okay, it's going to be some combination of the basis elements there. And you can ask, which cij are more than zero, or particularly which ones are equal to one. And it turns out that they're all automatically greater than or equal to zero, which has to do with the fact that everything in sight is really not just a real manifold, but a complex manifold, or at least a complex subvariety, and that extra geometry ends up leading to these numbers being non-negative. But we don't have to really worry about that. Yep.
Exactly what you mean.
So, for example, H might be UN going into UN cross UN. So this would be H and this would be G. So if we were in that case, then we might take, then what this guy might be a product of the, a product of some Grassmannian with itself, right? If I have a coadjuvant orbit of this product, it's going to be a product of two coadjuvant orbits. So I might have Grassmannian times Grassmannian here, and then diagonally sitting inside, one copy of the Grassmannian. And then what I would have here would exactly be the multiplication structure on the cohomology of that Grassmannian, and I'd be asking, when I multiply two classes together, which classes come out? Which ones come out with coefficient one? So in that case, I would exactly be getting the puzzle question. Any questions? And the other H and G you should have in mind, of course, is H is UM cross UN and G is UMN. That's the one in the marginal question. So this is the input to Berenstein-Chamar and to Resserre. If you can answer these, if you can figure out which of these coefficients are positive, each one of those gets you an inequality on this branching from taking coadjuvant orbits of G and restricting them to H and seeing what coadjuvant orbits you get there, projecting them into H dual and seeing what coadjuvant orbits you get there. Okay, so in order to get anywhere, you need to be able to compute these. And I'll tell you the answer. So what is the cohomology ring of O lambda? This is for UN, lambda generic. And so now this is, now instead of a Grassmannian, I've got full flags. I have a full chain of subspaces. Remember, this thing was, we identified this with flags. 0 contained in V1, contained in V2, up to Vn, the set of all of those. Okay, so that's my manifold, the set of chains of subspaces, or the set of Hermitian matrices of this spectrum, this generic spectrum, you know, a simple spectrum. And I want to compute this cohomology ring. So Borel gives a nice answer to this in around 1950 or so, so quite some time ago. This is not the Borel of Borel measures. This is the son of the Borel of Borel measures. This is Armand, not Henri, I guess. Anyway, so the younger Borel, not so young anymore, died a few years ago, gave an answer to this, which is that it's isomorphic to, I said I was going to put complex coefficients, so I will, x1, x2, up to xn. So that's nice, a polynomial ring and n variables. We can understand those, but it's not just that. There are relations among the x's. And what the relations are is you mod out, you kill off symmetric polynomials with no constant coefficient. All right, let's see an example of that to have any idea what that means. So if n equals 3, then what I'm saying is I have three variables, x1, x2, x3, but x1 plus x2 plus x3, that's 0. X1, x2 plus x1, x3 plus x2, x3 is 0, and x1, x2, x3 is 0. Okay? And so if you want to write down a general element of this, then it can't be a very large degree. For example, what if you had, it takes a bit to see, but this will actually kill, these are enough to kill off any monomial of degree larger than 3. You could trade your x1 for an x for a minus x2 minus x3, and if you start getting like x1 times x2 times x3 somewhere, then you kill it. So this looks like you could go on forever, but once you impose these, then you only end up with things in degrees, in these polynomial degrees 0, 1, 2, and 3. And to be very, very technical, these guys are actually not considered to be degree 1. They are considered to be degree 2. And that 2 is really the dimension of the complex numbers. That's where that 2 comes from. So this is, I only mention that so that you know that my cohomology ring is all an even degree, and that's why it's commutative. It's a, there isn't odd, there isn't stuff in odd degree anti-commuting with things. But I'm not going to really need to worry about the degrees of things. So this is what one of these rings looks like in the case of a flag manifold. And what you do for a larger n is you kill off all the elementary symmetric polynomials instead of these three elementary symmetric polynomials. Now, this is not a very useful answer yet, because I don't want to see where X3 goes. I want to see where the Schubert classes go. So, as I say, this is from the 50s. And you can ask, where are the Schubert classes? How do they sit inside here? So to each stratum on my flag manifold, to each permutation, it's going to be, turn out, I'll remind you, there's going to be associated some Schubert variety, and then there's going to be associated to that some class, which now has to be some polynomial. And what polynomial it is kind of ambiguous, because I could take my polynomial and add this to it, and I would get a perfectly good other way to think about the Schubert class. So that's kind of annoying, that you can't just say, what's the polynomial associated to a Schubert to a Schubert variety. You have to say, what's the class? So it's really nice. So Lescu and Schützenberger. So this is Schützenberger, Marcel Schützenberger, okay, despite what it looks like. Lescu and Schützenberger in 82 found nice polynomial representatives. Okay, so I'll remind you what they're finding representatives of, and then I'll give you a formula for the Schubert polynomials due to Lescu and Schützenberger. Well, the formula is not due to them. The polynomials are. The formula is from the early 90s. Okay, so on O lambda, we've got, so which is this flags in CN, these flags. We have this subset, flags in CN, that are in position pi, where pi is a permutation of 1 up to n. Okay, so before I did it in this position I, where I was a k-element subset of 1 through n. And that's the right thing for the Grassmannian. But for flags, you want a chain of a 1-element subset contained in a 2-element subset contained in a 3-element subset up to n. And to remember where those elements add as you go from 1 to 2 to 3, you use a permutation. And so what this is, it's those flags up to Vn, which is Vn, such that the dimension of the intersection of Vi with Cj is greater than or equal to the number of ones in pi's permutation matrix. So pi's permutation matrix has some ones and a 1-1 in each row and column. And you look in this part of pi's permutation matrix. Okay, so that's the definition of a Schubert variety in the flag manifold. And it's what comes up in this Rayleigh trace calculation. The point was, on here you could define this Rayleigh trace where a Hermitian matrix went to trace of the Hermitian matrix times some decreasing thing. And that the critical points of that were when your matrix H was itself diagonal. For a generic lambda, there's n factorial such possibilities of the ordering the eigenvalues of lambda. Those n factorial are corresponding to these permutations. You ask what flows down to a particular, equals. What flows down to a particular critical point, and the answer is this stuff. So if you have a particular critical point I'm thinking about, a particular permutation, I ask which flags flow down to there, it's the ones that satisfy these intersection conditions. So what I want is, so we want a polynomial in these n variables that represents the class S pi, which is the class of this thing. And this is what Lescun, Schützenberger answered, and I'll tell you an answer in a minute. So just to reiterate, these guys, so this is a subvariety of, a subset of the flag manifold. So you hope that its class should be defining elements in the cohomology ring. There's the cohomology ring. If I want to tell somebody an element of this cohomology ring over the phone, I'll tell them a polynomial. So that's why I want a polynomial that that represents that. And by represents, I mean that two different polynomials might differ by something symmetric, and they would give me the same class. But maybe I want a particularly nice choice. And that's what I'm going to tell you now.
I guess I'm confused about having the n number of subspaces equal to Cn. I mean, that seems like the generic case.
Absolutely. This is the generic case.
And, okay. So why isn't the class, why does the class S pi differ for different permutations?
For different permutations, have different permutation matrices.
Right.
So this number will change, which means I'm putting different restrictions on my VI. So let's take a particularly strong case. What if we have, I wanted this. I wanted this over here. Sorry about that. Hi, bye, Jay. Just to make that convention fit better with cohomology instead of homology. So what if you have the anti-identity matrix? Then this will be very large. And you'll, like if I equals J, it'll have I things in it, and you'll find out VI intersects CI is I dimensional. You'll say, I know what VI is. It's the standard CI. So there would be, so then the Schubert variety would be 1 point. Okay. Whereas if you have the identity matrix, then that intersects as little as possible and you get almost everything. Any questions? All right. So I need to tell you a formula for Schubert polynomials and then tell you how to answer the quantum marginal problem with it. And then we'll be out of time. All right, so let me define a pipe dream. A pipe dream is a diagram in the lower right quadrant made of two plaquettes put together, or made from lots of plaquettes. The two plaquettes you get to use are this one and that one. Okay, and I want to fill this quadrant with those, and I want to use finitely many of these. Okay, so let's have an example. And if those are the only two times I use the crossing plaquette, then after that, it just looks like this. Okay? So there's a sort of a C afterwards that just ends up matching up what's down here with what's up there. Okay? So that's a pipe dream. There's one other condition, which is that no two pipes cross twice. Okay? So I don't want to see this thing and then this thing next to each other where these two pipes crossed and they crossed again. That's disallowed. Okay? What can you do with a pipe dream? You can follow the numbers coming in from the side and see where they come out. Yep. And you get some permutation of the positive numbers. And notice, because there's only finitely many of these, I said after a while it just looks like this C of elbows, and so this is the elbowed tile. So there's the crossing tile and the elbows tile. So after a while you just have this C of elbows, And that just ends up corresponding these with those. So your permutation fiddles with some finite number at the beginning, and then after that, it's the identity permutation that doesn't do anything. Right? And the theorem is that S pi can be represented. So in this version, there's a sequence of approximations to this theorem, and so, since I haven't given you any definition at all of Schubert polynomials, it's not clear what's being proved and what's being defined. But I'll say that the people who invented these lovely diagrams were Fomin and Kirillov in 94. And what they prove is that S pi can be represented by sum over pipe dreams with, so pipe dreams P, whose associated permutation is pi. And for each one of those, you take the product, for each one of those, you take the product over the crosses in P of the row that that cross appears in. Okay? So let's do one calculation like that. Up there. And the one calculation is, I'll calculate S132. And that's going to come from, I can either have a cross there or a cross there. And those are the two different ways, as it turns out, to get 132. So let's see, 123 goes in and 132 comes out. And this guy is worth X1 because the single cross that is in it is in the first row. And this guy is worth X2. Okay. So the definition that Lescaut and Schussenberger gave of their polynomials is very, very, very different. And it's done using these divided difference operators that Newton invented. And it's, as the term divided difference suggests, there's minuses in their definition. And it's very unclear from their definition that actually the Schubert polynomials have positive coefficients. So this is what algebraic combinatorialists do. They look at things with non-positive definitions and they try to give them positive definitions. Like computing those things by counting puzzles. And here's another example of that fascination. So what do you do with this in the quantum marginal problem? So you want to find these magic subspaces W and V. Or you don't want to find them, but you want to know whether they exist. And then if they do exist, satisfying some Schubert conditions, then you can infer a linear inequality on the marginals. So that was about looking at UM cross UN, going into UMN. And this guy's coadjoint orbits look like flags in CMN. And I'm going backwards to flags in CM cross, tensor flags in CN. So that's another property that I didn't tell you about, cohomology. The cohomology of a product is, in these good cases, the tensor product of the two cohomologies. So I've got, and I know what this looks like. This is C bracket Z11 up to ZMN modulo symmetrics. And this is C bracket X1 of Xm modulo symmetrics, but now I'm also putting on Y1 up to Yn modulo symmetrics. So the tensor product just means I use both sets of variables, and I have polynomials in X and Y here, and polynomials in Z. And what remains is to tell you what this map is, and the map is Zij goes to Xi plus Yj. So what do you finally do with this? You start with pi, a permutation of 1 up to mn. You compute S pi, which is a polynomial in Z11 up to Zmn. Sorry, something I didn't tell you but is true about Schubert polynomials is that these Schubert polynomials, not the classes, but these polynomials that have been written down here, they are a basis for all polynomials in infinitely many variables. So here I've got polynomials in the x's. That these are a basis for all polynomials in x1, x2, x3, on forever. If you take all pi here, which has sort of indicated that you want to take all permutations pi here. Okay, so I didn't finish what you do here. You start with this Schubert polynomial. You feed in the xi plus yj that we do here. Now, instead of having a polynomial in z's, you've got a polynomial in x's and y's. Expand in Schubert polynomials in x times Schubert polynomials in y. And each coefficient 1 gives an inequality. And I don't have time to say what inequality you get when you pick out one of these terms in this, but it relates the pi and the rho and the sigma, a sum over something about those, relating the eigenvalues of the two marginals and the eigenvalues of the of HAB. But I'm sure that'll all be in Kwiatkow's lecture. And I'll stop here.